You're about to enjoy Tryhards, courtesy of MTGCast.com. If you enjoy Tryhards or anything else supplied by MTGCast, please make a donation. Whether it's recurring or one time, you can help offset the very real overhead of bringing you the best podcasts in magic every week. MTGCast at MTGCast.com.
Lauren knocked on the door and she came in and she's like, yeah, you were sleeping in your chair again. I'm like, yep.
You just don't want to be stuck at the end of the dark alley being like, oh man, but this card is really cool and I really wish I could use it.
I'm so not buying you any more Christmas gifts.
And Sean, you're going to kick me right square in the nuts when I tell you the first one that dropped off the list.
That would draw the ire of a lot of people. I think you would lose 50% of your modern players.
I've literally been knocked from Kaladesh back to Chandelar.
She needs some love. She absolutely needs some love.
It's a tryptophan-induced episode of Tryhards. Though you brave soul, coming off the Thanksgiving leftovers, it is episode 28. The signal has gone up, the Tryhards have assembled, and we've got something a little bit different in store for you tonight. Our favorite format had a GP way across the Pacific, and after that, we're going to let our hair down a little bit here on Tryhards. It's all in the holiday spirit. We hope you'll enjoy. I'm Sean Seacrease, he's Brian Tibbetts, and he's Matt Hurley. Guys, we get it started every week with What Are You Drinking? I'm going to go first because the spoils of physical labor are watering my taste buds here this evening. There is a traditional lager that comes from down around Matt's new stomping grounds in Louisville. It's Yuengling, and I did a little bit of work to help Matt move, and he graciously supplied me with a case of the Yuengling traditional lager. And Matt, you're going to be horrified on one hand and not surprised on the other. Having a few people over this weekend, out of the case you brought me, I have the final two on the table for the cast tonight.
Wow.
You actually shared them, huh?
I did. I've got two friends of mine who came over who have family down in Louisville as well, and they didn't even ask once they saw them in the fridge, honestly.
Well, that's the kind of guest you kind of want at your house sometimes, but only when they take the free beer. Because if they start taking the stuff I buy, I'm like, whoa, just hold on there, Captain.
So, Brian, who was going through your fridge?
Nobody was going through my fridge. I was actually going through my sister's fridge up in Chicago this past weekend, which was great because her boyfriend had some great, great taste in beer, and Chicago has just got a phenomenal, reputation as a good brew town. And so I don't think I drank the same beer twice all weekend. To top it off, I had a Bitburger lager down at the German Christmas festival on the Friday after Thanksgiving. And when it's, 46 degrees outside, there's nothing like a cold, refreshing German lager to, wash down the holiday spirit. So, yeah, it was really fun.
It's also the way that Brian slides into his lederhosen, if you've never seen that. Matt, what are you drinking in Louisville?
Actually, on our trip back up home, we stopped by the grocery store, and I got something, one of my favorite beers that I can't get down here. Even if I ordered it through Lauren's work, it would cost me like $14 for a four-pack. So I'm drinking a 90-minute IPA, Dogfish Head.
Now, why can't you get that down there? That comes from over on the East Coast.
I have no idea, but very rarely is there's very little Dogfish Head around here. Even the 60-minute that's on the shelf in six-packs is like $11 to $12 for a six-pack. Tough to get, and we're up in Quincy. I picked this up, I think, for $8.99 for a four-pack, so I was like, I'll pick up a couple four-packs.
92 episodes from now, when we have the 120th episode of Tryhards, we'll do it after drinking a bunch of Dogfish Head 120 and see how long that show lasts here.
Do you mean two? Because we'll be passed out if we have more than two or three apiece.
Exactly. It'll be the first express edition of Tryhards.
4 minutes in. Well, thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Go to bed. Yeah.
Either that or we'll start to rip off heavy meta, one of the two. Guys, I know it was a holiday weekend. I didn't get to play any Magic. Did either of you two, Brian?
No, I did not get to play any Magic. There was actually a reject rare draft happening at the store yesterday, and I was actually hoping I could make it down, but alas, coming back from the trip didn't allow it, and then it didn't fire anyway, I don't think, because, everybody had the same issue. So, yeah, I was unable to play. What about you, Matt?
I actually played a little Magic Online. We did the trek up to Quincy on Thursday morning, And then we left Saturday morning. Well, I should say Saturday afternoon. We didn't get down here till Saturday night. The entire time I was fighting still the ear infection, and then the allergies are killing me. So I actually sat around most of yesterday and just played Magic on the computer. Ended up doing the Twisted, I think four of the Twisted drafts. The Twisted Cube drafts were kind of fun. I sent you guys some pictures of some ridiculous decks I had. And then the Kaladesh drafts were just whatever. And both of those I took second. That's kind of what paid me to get into a bunch of those Twisted drafts and get some cards on Magic Online. But other than that, it was just mostly screwing around. In fact, I think I fell asleep during one of the drafts, if you want to know the honest truth.
Well, you know, that's a good time.
Yeah,
Lauren knocked on the door and she came in. She's like, yeah, you were sleeping in your chair again. I'm like, yep.
Old man status unlocked for Matt here on Tryhards. Falling asleep in his office chair during a draft. There was no sleeping across the Pacific in Chiba over the weekend. It was the only GP, and it was our favorite format, Legacy. Guys, 2,502 players got involved. Only 2,002 of them paid to get in. You might be saying, wait, what happened? This was very cool. For the first time at the GP level of tournaments in history, a tournament organizer opened it up for 500 free entrants. This tournament in Chiba was run by Hare Ruya. That's the Tamaharo Saito company. He's the CEO of it. And he thought as an opportunity to grow Magic, and specifically the Eternal formats, he would open up 500 slots for players who were students. All of them were taken. And so 2,502 players at GP Chiba Legacy over the weekend. The top eight consisted of three Miracles decks, two Sneak and Show, one Storm, one Elves, and one Death and Taxes. And there were some interesting things that happened at the tournament. Lu Jin, he was the first competitor in a GP or higher level tournament to make top eight and become the Monarch. During top eight play, he was playing Death and Taxes and cast Palace Jailer in order to become the Monarch and draw the extra card. Yuya Watanabe made a bet that one of us would probably make with another one of ourselves. Watanabe.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, he took a bet that came from Kazuyuki Takamura that said if he made the top eight, he'd have to get a haircut just like Takamura. And Watanabe made the top eight with Miracles, and he said he will get Takamura's haircut, but in a twist, he will get it from the opposite side. Takamura has kind of one side of his head shaved and then combs the other over so that they could pose back-to-back for the Splinter Twin effect. I thought that was a lot of fun. But other than that, this was a tournament that was very interesting. Miracles, Sneak and Show. Sneak and Show taking it down when Kentaro Yamamoto on Sneak and Show defeated Atsuki Kihara. Kihara was on Miracles, and Yamamoto, who had just dropped out of the top 25 in the last rankings, now taking down a major GP. He should vault back into the top 25, guys. This tournament, I didn't get to see a lot of it because of the Thanksgiving weekend. I was traveling and doing other things. It seemed like it was a lot of fun, and I'll be interested to see if there isn't, Matt, some new tech that comes out of Chiba.
Most of our listeners know, and we all know, usually the Japanese are the trendsetters and the tech, kind of the techie people who aren't afraid to play around in the older formats, especially Vintage and Legacy. I did get to watch some of it. Unfortunately, it was in Japanese. It was at odd hours. But there was a group of streamers that got together that were Japanese and were translating the coverage over on Twitch. They did an okay job. I mean, it was nice to have that available so I could actually understand what was going on. But other than that, I mean, they were kind of talking amongst each other a lot, and it wasn't as focused as the coverage normally is. But some of the tech was, and this isn't new tech, was Fiery Confluence. Did you guys see any of that?
The Fiery Confluence in what, a Delve strategy?
No, it was just Big Red. He was running Chandra, Torch of Defiance, and Fiery Confluence.
Yeah, Chandra, Torch of Defiance, and the new Nissa both got some play over the weekend.
Yeah, no, I didn't see anything about the Fiery Confluence.
There was a Shardless deck that was 9-0 that was running Liliana the Last Hope and Leovold in the side. During the interview, I watched part of the interview. He said that he would actually move Leovold to the main and that he thought Liliana the Last Hope was better than Liliana the Veil in this current format. I'm going to think that, you know, I'm a trendsetter there.
Well, Hurley, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned this, that there were two decks in the top 25 or excuse me, in the top 32 that were food chains. Knowing how much you like a good food chain deck.
You have to take these results with a grain of salt. Meta is much, much different on that side of the pond than it is over here.
Of course.
So, but, yeah, no, I love seeing the food chain. I like seeing the food chain with the Eternal Scourge, which is that new card that you can cast from exile, and then whenever it's a target of a spell or ability, it exiles. Other than that, I mean, I just read through some of the articles on it, and I read through some of the Twitter stuff, but there was a lot of, like, little cool stuff here and there.
Yeah, little cool stuff here and there, and take a look when you get to early. Eric Brown's Shardless deck that's in 27th place was actually running Leovold in the main. And so he did have one main and did not have another one in the side, but was running a bunch of stuff that we've been talking about in the side. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I did see one of those in the top 32.
The other cards that were out there, the Death and Taxes, one of them, I don't know how to pronounce it, was running the Iganjo Castle, I'm guessing.
Oh, sure, the Iganjo Castle. Yeah,
yeah, they were running that. And then there was a lot of Manrique Gusaris in the sideboards. So they and some Cataclysms. So they had adapted some of the kind of old tech and then added in stuff like Recruit of the Guard and Sanctum Prelate and stuff like that on the Death and Taxes. Yeah, there was a lot of interesting stuff here. I mean, I definitely think some of this is going to translate over, and I do notice that some of this is just standard, but there's definitely a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, Iganjo Castle is something you see in Modern sometimes with the really aggro Geist of St. Traft decks. And then Manrique Gusari has been used for a long time to get a leg up when you expect a heavy equipment metagame. Anytime you're going to see opponents searching for Batterskull or for Pointy Stick of Doom, running Manrique Gusari has always been a way to kind of get a leg up on them. So it was interesting to see those little tweaks on what they expected in the metagame. Different question about a bigger picture, though. How much do you guys read into metagames when they come from different regions of the world? We know Europe likes their Bazaar of Moxen. There's a lot of Legacy. There's a lot of Vintage there. There are Legacy tournaments that are played at a high level in Asia. When you see results like this, Brian, I'll start with you. How much are you delving for tech to get an edge versus reading the metagame, knowing that different card availabilities and different play patterns are preferred on different spots around the world?
You know, reading as a meta, I don't think is actually that helpful. It comes down to sometimes, you know, matchups. It comes down to card choices on a very, very slight scale when you start looking at the, you know, top 8 versus the 9th through 32nd versus 33rd through 64th place. But what I do love about all the deck lists that they have printed is you get to start seeing, you know, what they were preparing for and kind of what's out there that you know you might want to put on your radar, and some of the sideboard choices might be kind of interesting. I think that's more about it. I would never use this as a way to really talk about you know, making a metagame switch overall. You know, looking at those kind of results. At the same time, it is really, really fun to take a look at, you know, what other people, especially in Europe, are doing, you know, from week to week and month to month.
I'm exactly with Tibbetts. I mean, these metagates, some of these are so inbred that, you know, running sideboard Manrique Gusari, I mean, that means that you're expecting a ton of Stoneblade, which Stoneblade's pretty popular in Japan. So I don't read into it too much. I do look for, Brian kind of mentioned, you know, some of that new tech, just to see if there's something that we could take over here and maybe change one or two cards, or even if there's just a brand new breakout deck that's hiding somewhere, and you know, in like that 50th place, 60th place, because that's kind of where everything gets bogged down and gets lost. One example of that in this is in Elves in 28th place, he's running a Wrenn's Run Packmaster. I mean, there's lots of like little tweaks that you can make, but there's really not a lot of like metagame choices that you can make that are based on this information.
I was going to say, yeah, Morwen block constructed staple, I believe, Wrenn's Run Packmaster.
It was a heck of a card in that too. I also, you know, when I'm looking at the deck list for these, I'm looking at, you know, a lot of people were on Miracles, and that was kind of running rampant through the top 32. But there were a lot of different lists. Not a lot of people were running the same stock list. Some people kind of had the Venser build that Joe Lissette seems to like. A lot of people were running the Mentor build, but, you know, different numbers of Mentor. Some people weren't running all four Counterbalance. Some people were running the Entreat package. It's kind of fun to see, you know, how people are building and why they're making the choices that they are. And as we were playtesting the Sultai deck, I put together a Miracles build, and then I'm thinking, well, geez, there's really no stock Miracles build now. There's, you know, four or five kind of accepted builds. And so I just kind of chose one, and I'm thinking, huh, how would the matchup have gone had I had this card or this card? And that's the kind of fun thing to do is, you know, what are you preparing for? One matchup, you're preparing for the whole field, and that's what we should do. You prepare for the whole field. So looking at some of this stuff, although really fun and kind of gets the brain working, it sometimes can run you down the wrong path. You just don't want to be stuck at the end of the dark alley being like, oh, man, but this card is really cool, and I really wish I could use it. It's like, well, if it's not going to do anything for you, you should probably just leave it at home.
Oh, yay. We have a Legacy metagame that now has you prepare for Control Miracles or Aggro Miracles. Just exactly what we were all hoping for right before Christmas. GP Chiba, it was in effect over the weekend. You can see all the details on the mothership. Guys, before we get into our fun segment for the week this week, we got an email from Tevis. Brian, I'll throw this to you because you were the first one to respond. Tevis says, big fan of the cast. Issue is I'm moving from MTG cast and using an RSS to pull all my favorite casts. I wouldn't want to miss out on tryhards. Anyway, if I'm to continue to be a brazen soul that I desire to be, I'll need an RSS feed from you guys to make it work. Do you have one set up? Brian, you said you were going to look into this.
I did. And here's the thing. We can't set up an RSS feed ourselves. The RSS feed has to come from MTGcast. That's the way I understand it. I've got a call in to a tech friend of mine who has not gotten back to me because he took some extended vacation over the Thanksgiving holiday. But to my knowledge, and these are just the people I've talked to, a website that hosts multiple podcasts like MTGcast, they're the ones responsible for doing the RSS feeds, and then you can kind of pick and choose what you want off that page. So if MTGcast does not have the RSS feed, then we, unfortunately, will not have the RSS feed. If I get different information, I will definitely pass that along next week. Unfortunately, that's where we are right now.
Looks like we're going to have to spend two generic mana, crack a clue, and look for answers for you, Tevis, here on Tryhards. That brings us up to this week's bit of unusually forecast fun on Tryhards. We usually like to stay with our mantra, full-time adults, part-time Magic players. We're ambassadors for the game. We love Legacy. We love Magic in all of its various forms and all its incarnations over the years. Yes, even pre-New World Order. But this week, with the holiday just having been last week, and now we're heading toward more holidays, we thought that for the first time, we'd kind of let our collective hair down, sorry Hurley, and have a little bit of fun with a ranking here on Tryhards. There's one thing that everybody has an opinion on, and that's the advent of Planeswalkers in the game. They debuted in Lorwyn Block. There are now, as far as I could tell, 82 individual Planeswalkers. Those include the flip creatures that turn into Planeswalkers along the way. And so we thought we'd have some fun and rank our own personal top 25 this week and see just how much crossover we have. Now, before we reveal our lists, I have some predictions for how this part of the cast is going to go. I think that we'll all have the same number one. I think that while we may have the same numbers 2 through 5, none of us will have them in exactly the same order. I think there will be some picks that each of us make that the others have left off. One, because, well, maybe we forgot. And two, because maybe we think that person is just dead wrong. So we're going to get into it all here this evening here on Tryhards. For the first time, doing a top 25 list, our top 25 Planeswalkers. Guys, do you want to reveal any sort of maybe stats about your list before we get started? I'll give you a hint. I'll go first. Jace was the most often referenced Planeswalker in my top 25. And there were only two other Planeswalkers that got more than one mention. I'll reveal those at the end. One, you won't be surprised. One's quite the dead giveaway. And I'll get it started with my honorable mentions before we get in. I'd like to give honorable mention to Tamio Moonsage, Nicol Bolas Planeswalker, a Johnny Caller of the Pride, and Deathrite Shaman.
Planeswalker.
Yep.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed with that. Man, you left Tamio off? That's kind of shocking.
She didn't make my top 25. Brian, do you have anything you'd like to set up before we get into the list?
I felt like I had to separate the brewer side of me from the deep in the heart side of me when I was looking at the Planeswalkers. And even though I haven't played with a lot of these, the pull of their strength and their power was just too much for me to ignore. And so maybe they're not the most efficient planeswalkers. Maybe they're only narrow in certain decks, but I kind of had to put them high just because I know what they can do, and I kind of fear what they would do if they found out I didn't rank them high.
Matt, how did you end up putting this list together?
I looked at kind of overall power level. If it's very powerful, and there's several of these that are super powerful, but they go in very, very specific decks that are very, like, kind of narrow, that dropped them down to rankings. So that's kind of what I used. It was, like, overall power level. And then once we get towards, I guess, towards the bottom of the top 25, I looked at basically, okay, does this do an effect? And then a big one was, does it protect itself? So is this something I can plop down and it's a must kill because it's just going to snowball out of hand? And I think that kind of rolls into the power level. The two that I actually dropped off my list, and Sean, you're going to kick me right square in the nuts when I tell you the first one that dropped off the list. And I think it's because I never played with it other than in Cube, was Jace Bellerin.
Okay, I can see that. Just because there have been so many powerful Jaces printed, and Bellerin's main use in tournament play outside of Standard when they were first debuted was as a trump under the old Legend rules to take away the other player's Mind Sculptor. So
right,
I can see
that. That's the only time. He didn't make my list either. So
yeah, he didn't
totally
make mine either.
Okay. And then the other one was, well, there's actually two other ones. Kiora the Crashing Wave, I think that's pretty powerful. Didn't make my list, though. And then the other one that kind of dropped off was Sarkhan the Unbroken.
Okay, he didn't make my list. Yeah. If we would have been talking about raw power, he would have made my list, but then my list would look a little bit different. I kind of did mine as in, if you were a multi-format, multi-deck all-star, you were ranked toward the top. And then I looked at planeswalkers that had either decks built around them, archetypes built around them, maybe they were multi-format role players. And then I just kind of ranked them in my mind based on those things. So I think this will be very interesting as we get started. Let's go from 25 to 1. So we'll start at the back end and work from the bottom up, so to speak. And let's take them in groups of five. So, Tibbetts, what I'd like to do, let's start with you. Give us your number 25 through 21. So kind of your bottom five of the top 25, if you will, and throw in anything you want along the way.
So these are the ones that, you know, when you get down to this list, it's kind of hard to really rank them, so to speak. Here's my 25 through 21. 25, I had Domri Rod. 24, Garrick Primal Hunter.
Ooh.
23, Garrick Wild Speaker. 22, Chandra Flame Caller. And 21, Jace Architect of Thought, which I didn't think was that going to end up that high on my list or that low on my list, but when I look at everything else, I kind of feel comfortable. So, guys, what do you think? Did I totally miss the mark here?
Well, hold on. Let's do this. Matt, give us your 25 through 21,
okay,
and then I'll give mine, and we'll kind of see where this is going. Matt?
25, I've got Garruk, Apex Predator. 24, I've got Xenagos the Reveler. 23, I've got Johnny Steadfast. 22, I've got Tameo the Moonsage. 21, I have a Johnny Mentor of Heroes. And 20,
oh, hold
I have
on,
Chandra
hold on, hold on. You've, whoa, you went six on us there. 25 to 21
oh,
is five.
Yep.
So we'll
yep.
stop there. Interesting, because I thought I was the only one who liked Apex Predator, though he didn't make my list. Starting at number 25, I had Garrick Primal Hunter. Number 25, Dak Faden, Greatest Thief in the Multiverse, at number 24. Ashiok, Nightmare Weaver, at 23. Sarkhan the Mad at number 22, and this was a little bit because I played him a lot in Standard when he came out, and because of his place in history, being the only Planeswalker ever developed that only gets minus counters, where I thought he was unique because literally everything on his card is accessible the turn that you play him, which made him powerful in unusual ways. And then at number 21, and I'm taking a little bit of a flyer on this one, because she's impressed me early, and I think she may have some great things in her future, Tameo Field Researcher.
Oh,
so very Field Researcher, yeah.
And I'm trying not to put this list together with a recency bias, because one of the things I was worried about is that we might have some recency bias, and then being old men like we are, we might have some rose-colored glasses, everything was better in the past bias. So I tried to walk the line between those two.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, Tameo didn't even make the Field Researcher didn't make my list, but it's also one of those things where I think it's the other side of the recency bias, where I never played with her because she just wasn't in the deck during, you know, well, I mean, still standard legal, obviously, but she's never been in a deck I've played. And so I've looked at her. It seems like a lot of fun, but kind of like what Hurley said about Kiori the Crashing Wave, powerful, but just didn't make the cut.
That's
a solid choice, though.
I expect her to start showing up in modern events, and maybe I'm giving her undue respect because I've gotten my backside kicked by her so often, it seems like, when she shows up in standard. All right, I'll kick off the next set, 20 through 16. Number 20 for me, Obnixilus Reignited. He just does what you want as either a black theme or a black role player, draws you cards, kills other stuff. This was the first one that was real controversial for me because she was so narrow. But in the decks that she was a part of the strategy and synergy, she really helped put him over the top, and that's Nissa Vastwood Seer. I had her at 19. Chandra Flamecaller at number 18 because she was so versatile. I thought for the first time that Wizards really broke out of the mold of what red could do for a planeswalker with her ability to both kill other planeswalkers as a trump, to draw cards, to kill things on the field. They stayed within the flavor of red, but I thought she gave you some different tools. So Chandra Flamecaller makes it number 18 for me. This is the first time I think we're going to fight because you guys are going to say this is too low. Jace Vryn's Prodigy at 17 for me, and then Domri Raid at number 16. Yes, ahead of Jace. When he was in standard, he was the backbone of the aggressive Gruul deck. He's had splash play in both what was extended then, is now modern, and in Legacy as well, before decks really consolidated and left Zoo and those aggressive style decks on the outside. You look at aggressive decks now, they're more combo or combo control decks, whether it's Merfolk or Elves. And the real aggressive decks, I played Zoo, I played Five Color Zoo, used Domri Rod. Those decks have been pushed out of the metagame right now, but he was a real role player across formats, and I thought that earned him that spot on my list. Brian, take us through your 20 to 16.
20, and I think this is one that's going to be a little bit too low, and maybe upon further reflection, I'd probably put her higher. Chandra, Torch of Defiance, she just hasn't quite done it for me. I know she's showing up in more and more decks, and she's probably going to make me eat my words, but there she is, 20. 19, I've got a Johnny Mentor of Heroes. 18, I've got the Greatest Thief in the Multiverse, Dak Faden.
Mm.
17, one we have not yet mentioned, Elspeth Terrell, which I think is, you know, maybe, yes.
Oh, she didn't and even make my list.
Oh, well, you know what? That's fine. That's fine, but she needs some love. She absolutely needs some love.
Fifth best Elspeth. Are the other four on your list too?
Well, you know what? I'm a little partial to the ladies because I got other Elspeth on my list for sure. I would say that she's not gotten all the love that she needs. Elspeth is one of those planeswalkers that I think, in a vacuum, if you look at her, the way that she could end a game or take over a game is something that just hasn't been realized. And I think that's kind of where Charger Torch of Defiance kind of ends up too. I feel like there's more room for her to grow, and maybe she's like, I don't know, the Tybalt of the Elspeth. She just hasn't found her way in the right deck, so who knows. So that's my 17. And 16, I've got Tamiyo, the Moon Sage. So okay. I just think her controlling thing puts her kind of square in that, you know, very middling range. So Hurley, you're up.
20, I've got Chandra Pyromaster. I actually think she's more powerful than Flamecaller because she's a 4-drop.
Sure, so, I'll listen to that argument.
Yeah, Flamecaller didn't even end up on my list. That was another one that was kind of like pushed off. It's very powerful, but I just don't see it. I don't think out of 6-drop it's going to see enough cross-format to play, and it doesn't necessarily protect itself. So that's where I was looking. 19, I've got Garrick Primal Hunter. 18, I've got Sorin, Lord of Innistrad. 17, I've got Dak Faden. And 16, I have Chandra, Torch of Defiance.
Okay, we got a little recency bias.
Okay, so you put her a little lower, too. Sorin, Lord of Innistrad?
Yep.
He didn't even make my list. And Brian,
he didn't make my list either. I think he's the fourth worst Sorin.
No, I think he's better than Solemn Visitor.
Well, we're going to have fighting words now because, see, he's on my list and we're getting into the top 15.
Solemn Visitor, I feel like when he protects himself, when he has to protect himself, he has to minus two, and then he's down to two. With Lord of Innistrad, unless you've got a flyer, you can take him up to four, and then you got one black vampire with lifelink, so he can protect himself, and then he just snowballs out of control there.
Throwing down on a 1-1? You play a Solemn Visitor, and all your guys get lifelink until the next turn. Nobody wants to attack them.
Until the end of the turn? Until your next turn?
Exactly.
When you block the next turn. And this is the guy who's been playing Mardu Tokens and Sorm Solemn Visitor.
He got a spot in Five Color Zoo for me. I mean, this is going out of the sideboard, admittedly, but he's amazing.
If you stack those two in a vacuum, I look at it and I think Lord of Innistrad is better than Solemn Visitor.
Wow, okay, our first big disagreement. Top 25 Planeswalkers from the Tryhards, Sean, Brian, and Matt. All right, Matt, lead off this group for us. Now we're getting into the big ones. Now we're top 15. 15 through 11. Matt, you just drew our ire for that pick, so go ahead.
Garrick Relentless at 15.
Oh, he didn't even make my list. The only Garrick that made my list was Primal Hunter.
Oh, my.
At 25.
I think he is super powerful. I mean, just being able to flip and make 1-1 death touch, 2-2 tokens, do it. He's so versatile.
Okay, go ahead.
And with single green. And then Vincer the Sojourner on 14. Ashiok on 13. Karn Liberated at 12. And Nicol Bolas at 11.
Wow. Okay, first of all, I love expensive planeswalkers. I play Nykvit, for God's sakes. And I love expensive planeswalkers. You heard me. Lord Bolas didn't make my top 25. He was in honorable mention earlier. But Karn's going to exile you from your list once you hear where I have him on mine. I just couldn't get on board with the multiple Garricks. I had Primal Hunter at 25. Because if you've ever sat on the other side of the table from Primal Hunter, it's a beating, and I've played Relentless in multiple formats, and he always seemed to need so much support to be good. You give him that, he'll take the game over, but to me, he never was the one threat you'd want on the board.
As far as Relentless, I think about him just either shooting down, if you need to, shooting down a Delver or doing whatever, but I just think he's very versatile. And as far as Karn goes, Karn and Ugin were, I will tell you, and you'll find out later, we're kind of fighting it out here. Karn and Nicol Bolas, I think Nicol Bolas is just so absurdly powerful that he deserves to be on the list. I mean, yes, he's very mana intensive and he's very color intensive, but he is just so absurdly powerful. I mean, if we were looking at raw power, just straight raw power, ignoring any mana cost or any requirements, I mean, I think he would probably be in the top five of all time.
Oh, he'd be number one. If there's one card, and I was thinking about this earlier, if I told you you can start the game with one Planeswalker already in play, it's got to be either Karn or Bolas, and I think Bolas wins because he either leaves your opponents with no permanence or takes their best creature on every turn. So if you played the game where you get one Planeswalker to start the game, take anyone you want, I think he's it. So, I mean, that says something.
So that's why I ranked him highly. Karn, the reason he kind of dropped a couple spots, though, is because he doesn't have kind of a board wipe. So that once you get to that 7, even though, yes, with the, modern Tron, you can pop up the 7, within 4 turns or so. A lot of times you're facing down 2 or 3 creatures. And, yes, I understand he goes up to 10 loyalty. And then, he gets pinged down to maybe, 8 or 6 or so. I just feel like he might deserve a higher ranking, but he's kind of fighting it out for that, I guess, that 6 through 15 spot, and I think he deserves to be in the middle of that pack.
From a lore standpoint, if we can let you put Vencer and Karn in the same block, since one of them literally killed himself to bring the other one back, so we're going to have to get a flavor judge on the cast.
We're playing with some dangerous power here, that's all I got to say.
All right. I got to say, I love Vencer. I'm a huge, I don't know, I think that's bias on my part. But I think Vincer's so powerful. He is one of my favorite planeswalkers.
Well, I think so too, but he never had a major tournament impact, and that's why I left him off my list.
No, he did not. I mean, I've played him in blue-white Stoneblade before. I mean, he is just super, super powerful. He's in a little bit odd at colors, but yeah, he's one of my favorites. I think that's probably some bias, but every time I get him, like whenever he's in cube, whenever he's in anything, he's just ultra powerful.
All right, I'll give you my 15 through 11 now, because this is going to be the second iteration of the Planeswalker that surprised me. We'll get there in a minute. Number 15 for me, Soren Solemn Visitor. You heard our argument on that a moment ago. Number 14, Jace Architect of Thought. Yeah, I had him ahead of Vryn's Prodigy. If you've ever played Architect of Thought in Control, sort of day in and day out, I still think he's better. Number 13, Xenagos the Reveler. You guys sat across the board from these green, red ramp decks during Theros block. He was the engine behind it, and he got scary in a hurry. And I learned to give him his respect because in even control decks starting adopted him for the mana, for the 2-2 haste attacker. He did so much. Xenagos the Reveler surprised me when he ended up at number 13. Number 12, Koth of the Hammer. If you played him during Scar's block, he was the architect of Big Red. He was the card that let you play it and be versatile as far as aggressive versus mana ramp. We've seen him on the back of a Rogue Scred Red deck in Modern. Koth of the Hammer, my number 12. And for the second time on the list, this is the Planeswalker that surprised me. I only had three Planeswalkers that had more than one appearance. Sarkhan Vol. You guys were playing when Sarkhan Vol was out. He was amazing. At a four drop for an aggressive strategy, his plus was to give your creatures haste. His minus was a repeatable threaten effect. And then he had a combo aspect to him where you could play your Sarkhan, one that was in play, minus four him, minus six, which was only two turns. Make, was it 5/4/4 dragons? 5/4/4 dragons. Then drop the second one out of your hand, give them all haste in 1/1. It was a combo kill that some more creative control decks started adopting in that format as well. So Sarkhan Vol as a four drop, if you didn't play in that era, you didn't know the terror of putting something out when you thought you had control of the board, watching them drop him, steal it, hit you with it, maybe sacrifice it, maybe do something else with it, and then a couple turns later, they had a combo kill that if you didn't have a counterspell for, you had to have two kill spells because the dragons got 1/1, so they were coming in for 25.
Yeah, no, I remember that, and that was way, way, way serious. This is one of those that it was such a corner case, though. That's why Sarkhan didn't make my list. I totally remember that and getting just kind of blown out of the water a few times and kind of you just look down and you're like, yep, I guess that's game. No, you're absolutely right, Sean. He's total value down and can attack you from many, many angles. So, yeah, that's a respectable 11 for sure.
I didn't play during that era, and unfortunately, I didn't. I mean, I know he's powerful from playing him in Cube, but that's my only – and some in EDH, but that's my only experience with Sarkhan Vol. So that's – unfortunately, that's the reverse bias there, is where a lot of these Planeswalkers I just didn't play with.
All right, those are my 15 through 11. Brian, take us through yours, and then the top 10s around the corner.
Well, Sean, I feel like, you know, you and I should, I don't know, play the lottery or something, because we both had Soren Solemn Visitor at 15, right at 15. So
great minds.
Hurley, you're just absolutely wrong on that.
So, I could be. I mean, I don't know.
I'm not going to say, because the other three that he had in his 15 through 11, I just didn't have on my list. So, you know, there's where we part ways. Okay.
What?
So. Right, yeah, listen to this. All right. Soren Solemn Visitor is 15. Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas, is 14.
Oh, you're what? Not giving him enough respect.
What?
Well,
you're gonna crap yourself when we get higher up there.
Oh,
well, then that's fine.
I'm on Team Hurley on this one, I think.
All right, 13 is where I put Nicol Bolas. He fell lower than I wanted him to, but that's where I put Nicol Bolas. 12, Ashiok. I feel like Ashiok's not gotten all the love. And then 11, I'm coming in with the big white man himself, Gideon Jura.
Okay, first of all, also too low. And I can't believe I'm always the one trying to force Ashiok into decks. I had him at 23. You guys both had him in the top 20. So maybe I'm not his number one fan or her number one fan.
I think I've been turned a little bit.
All right, that is Brian's 15 through 11. The top 10 is about to get contentious right now. Yeah. All right, Brian, we started this with you. Let's swing back around to you. 10 through 6, and you got to explain in the top 10, you got to explain why they got that slot from you.
Well, first of all, I was going to say the 1 through 10 was, I looked at 10 as like my cutoff. These are my all-stars. And so the 10 of 11, 11 is Gideon Jura. And you're right, he probably should have made the top 10, but, you know, that's just the way it goes. But I feel very confident in my top 10. All right, here we go. 10 through 6. At 10, squeaking into the top 10, a Johnny Vengeant.
Oh, I'm so not buying you any more Christmas gifts.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm totally fine with that. Number 9, you guys are going to hate me. Elspeth Knight Errant.
That's probably right.
Okay, I understand that you guys forgot how to play Magic back when Planeswalkers first came out, so I'll just let it go.
I did not play Elspeth, so I don't know. Why do you say that, Sean?
Well, first of all, she was a 4-drop. She had 2+ abilities, and both took you up to an unbeatable ultimate. And yes. Whether or not you needed creatures or you needed to kill your opponent faster, both of her abilities that were both plus abilities allowed you to do the best thing in any situation. So
okay, so you're making the argument she needs to be ranked higher. I thought you were making the argument she didn't even need to be on the list, and I was going to slap you.
Oh, no. We'll get to her later on my list. Go ahead, Brian.
Okay.
All right, so let's see. Number 8, Gideon, Ally of Zendikar.
Really?
7.
Okay, because he didn't make my list. He was the one omission on my list that I didn't know what to do with, because he's a standard all-star right now, but he hasn't crossed over and done anything else. So I kind of want to see where he goes, and I don't know if he has the long-term power of a Tamiyo field researcher or somebody who gives you other angles on the metagame.
Oh, I think he's absolutely slotted in. The fact that he can turn into a creature, the fact that he can protect himself, and the fact that he can just, you know, make creatures at will, it's pretty incredible. Plus, right. Pumping your entire team. I mean, you just sack him and he's suddenly an intangible virtue and the other one, the new one from.
I mean,
from
he's
Elder
seen
two.
Multiple sideboard slots in Modern and Legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
And
all
I
right.
think it's I think he's becoming a main board
okay.
card too.
All right, Brian.
Right.
Go
all
ahead.
Right. So that's my 8 is Gideon, Ally of Zendikar. 7, I have Elspeth, Sun's Champion. And 6, Liliana of the Last Hope.
All right, Hurley. Go ahead, all 10 right. through 6.
So I need to preface my top 10 with something here. I never played with Gideon Jura, and I've heard you guys talk about how powerful he is. He's not even on my list because I've never played with him.
Okay. We're going to go back and delete all of Hurley's picks.
I mean, because he was only played – I came back in right around M11, M12. And he was only played when he was in Rise. He wasn't played when he was in M12 that much.
Sean, it sounds like Hurley would have picked Greg Odom in the NBA draft a few years ago. Too.
I totally agree. We would have sat there, of course, and picked anyone else but Greg Odom. But he would have picked Greg Odom.
All right. So number 10, I've got Nahiri the Harbinger. She just does so much. Loots, and then she's a reason for you to have just a one of big fatty, so she just randomly wins the game in two or three turns depending on what you use her for. I mean, she just does everything you want her to do as far as controlling the board.
That's why she should be higher.
I
what's her downside? What are you saying her downside is?
I'd say her only downside is she can't protect herself that
yes,
easily.
I would say that's one big downside. Another one is that she's red white.
Agreed.
The third downside is that, crazy as it sounds, throwing that one of Imrakul into your deck does have an opportunity cost to it.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I could hear an argument for her being higher, but not crazy lower. I mean, maybe down to 15 or so, you know.
Okay.
So number 9, Ugin the Spirit Dragon. That is absolutely biased on my part. Him being able to wipe the board, him being able to just bolt things, and then his not having difficulty getting to his ultimate, I rank him higher than Karn Liberated just because he has that board wipe on there. So I love my Ugins. I know that's probably way too high for Ugin, but that's where he is number 9. Number 8, Elspeth Knight Errant. I mean, she just does whatever you want her to do. She doesn't see a lot of play anymore because I think partially is because she's older, an older Planeswalker, and people are looking for, you know, the new fun tech. And then other problem with her, I think, is really that there's a lot of 4-drop spots in Eternal formats, and you have more specialized things you want to do there. She's kind of a, I would say, a Swiss Army knife. Number 7, I have Jace Friend's Prodigy. In Eternal formats, I mean, having a 2-drop, that most of the time you can flip into a planeswalker in a turn or two, and then you'll get to either flash stuff back or have a plus that you can get up to one target creature. I mean, he is just so good. And then first pickable in limited formats are almost always looters of some type, and being able to loot in a actual constructed format is just killer. And then number six, I had Gideon, Ally of Zendikar. This is the first planeswalker, I think, in existence that you want to play. If you're playing any, you're playing four in standard now, because you can just drop him, get an emblem. Typically, those emblems only cost three mana, so you're getting a one-mana upgrade to have an actual planeswalker that stays on the board. So he is just super powerful.
All right, that's 10 through 6 with Hurley. Time for me to jump in. I think this is the line for when you consider the Planeswalker Hall of Fame. You remember those NBA commercials from the 80s and 90s when it was like, what are you going to do to get in? I'm thinking like Shaq and Larry Bird and Magic Johnson.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, they were doing those things. That's what I think about when you get to the top 10. So based on her showing so far, her body of work is not complete, but she has all the tools to take her to the Hall of Fame. Number 10 for me, Nahiri the Harbinger, for reasons that Hurley has already laid out. Number 9, and this is when we get in to solid gold all-stars. He is so good. He has an entire format built around him in Legacy, Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas. He's the he's the reason that Bolas is as much of a threat across the multiverse as he is. It's Tezzeret, Agent of Bolas at number 9. Number 8 for me, and I can't believe I have him ranked higher than Matt, Ugin the Spirit Dragon. And this is just because he has been used as a multi-archetype finisher and threat. From Esper in Standard to Green X, Candelabra Ramp in Legacy, to Green Red being played as now Green White as well, with Tron in Modern. He is a multi-deck, multi-strategy, top-of-the-curve finisher that every deck can build to and every deck wants to have because he's so versatile. So Ugin, number 8 for me. Number 7, Elspeth, Sun's Champion. This is the girl who ended Pro Tours. She was a multi-format threat. She cleaned the board. She ended the game. She did everything you wanted. Even as a 6-drop, she's found a home in older formats. Elspeth, Sun's Champion, and then the OG Gideon Jura at number 6. He was considered for a ban in Standard during Callblade. This is how good he was. He played the game for your opponent. And people who don't understand how powerful that is, you go back and look at decks in this era and look at decks in this archetype. He was a stone cold killer when it came to your opponent trying to think their way through the game. Once you played him, they could only do what you let them do. He's so good that Wizards won't print planeswalkers that do what he did anymore.
See, I just didn't play with them, so I don't understand the power that he has.
It was unbelievable.
He was absolutely an all-star. And I could, Sean, I think you're absolutely right. He probably belongs in the top 10 for sure. He was just out of my top 10 at 11. But no, when you were playing against Gideon Jura, it's Hurley, the only thing I can tell you is when you sit down across from somebody and they throw down Gideon, Ally of Zendikar today, and you know that you've got a very, very limited time before the game ends, it was worse. It was worse back then. Wouldn't you agree, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. He, instead of making a knight to just kind of dirtle block, he just killed their best threat on the other side of the board. Whereas Ally of Zendikar attacked for 5, he attacked for 6 and was still indestructible. And he started at a higher loyalty, didn't he, Brian? I mean, this was something that was just almost unbeatable at this point. And this is before they had printed anything like Hero's Downfall or Ruinous Path.
Oh, yeah, you just couldn't get rid of him. You just couldn't get rid of him. And that was the whole thing about Gideon Jura. Yeah, he started at a 6 loyalty. Mm-hmm. And when you plus him to 8 during target opponent's next turn, creatures that player controls attack Gideon Jura, if able, talk about just kind of stoning your opponent. That's just nuts.
And they weren't absolutely able to keep defenders back.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you opened him up to an alpha strike as well. So he was just so versatile. That's the 10 through 6. Now, the top 5. And I can't believe that you guys have already ticked off some of my top five, but you guys have not named either of my top two, so I think this will be very interesting. So, Matt, let's start with you. Top five, once again, give us your reason why. Five through one, starting with your number five and ending with number one. Hit us up.
There is one card that I actually just flat out forgot how much I hated that card, and that was Elspeth Sun's Champion. I did not rank her on 25, and that was a mistake on my part. So I will preface that because I just totally forgot about that until you guys started talking about her.
Right, oh, just got she's just sidebar.
Yeah, Sean was right. She just ended games, ended Pro Tours. Yep. That thing hits the board. I mean, I remember playing in that standard deck with the blue-white Sphinx's Revelations deck. Or no, excuse me, not the Sphinx's Revelations, the control during Theros block, and my goodness.
Oh, I remember now that you guys are talking about her, but I just never saw her in any other formats, and so she just kind of just forgot about her. So I apologize to Elspeth Sun's Champion, even though she's dead right now. Here's my top five. So number five, I have Liliana the Last Hope. I think that's her plus. I mean, we've discussed her at length, but I think her plus of being able to, you know, give a target creature -2/-1, possibly killing it, going up to 4 loyalty right off the bat, being able to get stuff from your graveyard, and then she builds to her ultimate much quicker than you think she would. Her ultimate is just unstoppable as long as you can hang on for another two or three turns. So
the only thing I'm going to say about that is that she's just got to show me a little bit more in non-standard formats.
I think she's getting there. I think it's with her and the Veil, I mean, it's just they're right there. They're right next to each other. We had that discussion on a previous show, but I think she's definitely top five. Number four, and I can't believe this, is a Johnny Vengeant. I mean, he's just so powerful. Who ranked him so much lower than that?
Yeah. It's like somebody that's never played Control in their life. I don't know.
Good. Give me a break.
He taps something down. It's nice that it's a permanent. He Lightning Helixes for his -2 and then destroying all their lands. I mean, come on. Who doesn't want that? That one I think is definitely biased. I mean, he should probably be in that 6-10 block, but no, he's just so good.
No, he's good. You're absolutely right about that. I think what shoved him way high on my list, or higher on my list, I should say, at 10 was because he doesn't protect himself very well. Starting at 3 loyalty, and if you want to come in and Lightning Helix, I mean, paying 4 for a Lightning Helix, no thanks.
I can definitely see that. I mean, like I said, I think that's some bias there. I should probably have him in that 6-10 area. So number three, I have Liliana the Veil.
Really? That? Okay, yeah. That's fine. I mean, we're getting to the absolute tip top of the mountain here.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, she
I'm
has...
I'm just curious as your two. I'm curious as your two.
She is a multi-format, Hall of Fame, all-star, build around me, solid gold, first choice. So, I mean, we're in the top three now. So, yeah, what's your number two? Let me guess. Let me guess. Agent Ebolus.
Nope.
Really?
What?
Jace the Mind Sculptor.
Like I said before, we're now deleting all of Hurley's picks from the cast.
There's wrong, and then there's this wrong. He's just this wrong.
Defend yourself.
Mind Sculptor is obviously tip-top. He's one of, you know, obviously, if not the best, the number two, in my opinion, of any Planeswalker ever made. He controls the board. He's a little slow and kind of getting set up. I mean, you can bounce, you can brainstorm, you can do a lot of things. So he is the true, true Swiss Army knife that Control wants. The problem is that if the formats are going, if these old school formats are going wide, he's not as good as he once was because the New World Order is creature heavy formats, and he fits into a format where it's a very controlly, non-creature heavy format. I'm of the thought that if they unbanned him in Modern, I don't think there would be tons and tons of players playing him. I don't think he would warp the format. I think he would definitely change the format, but I don't think he needs to be banned in Modern because there's so many ways to just either get rid of him or stop him from working, or a lot of these decks, like I said, just go wide, and then they're like, oh, yeah, here, you can bounce that one. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and, you know, Serum Visions, whatever, scry all this crap to the bottom, and you fate sealed me for what? For nothing. So I don't think he would totally warp the format, but I think he would definitely change the formats.
Well, Jace is still in prison in modern for sins of the past. So
yes.
that's why he's there.
That's yeah. very true. But I also see if you unban Jace in modern, you suddenly have Rise of Miracles in modern because there's a way to set the top of your library. And that's scary. That's very, very scary.
That is scary. That's one of those things, though, I think that by the time you're setting that up, it's turn 4, turn 5 when you're setting that up. You're already dead. I mean, you're dead to Infect. You're dead to all these other decks.
In a Path to Exile Lightning Bolt deck that has Remand and Mana Leak? I don't think so.
If, you know, we've got something like that in... If you've got Counterbalance out with a 3-2-1 that you can reset at the top of your library, that would draw the ire of a lot of people. I think you would lose 50% of your modern players over the course of, you know, one Pro Tour. Or not a Pro Tour, but a season.
Oh, yeah. It would definitely change the format drastically.
All right. This has been a great conversation. What's your number one?
You've got to defend your one, then.
Yeah. What's your number one?
What do you think my number one is?
Well, it's got to be Tezzeret.
Yeah, it's Agent of Bolas.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow, the king is dead. Long live the king.
Exactly. That I was just looking. I was just like, geez, he's got EOB at 1. Wow.
Okay, now you got to defend the number one pick.
Agent of Bolas is +1 him, and you kill your opponent next turn. It ends the game next turn almost every single time because he goes into an artifact deck. Now, artifacts are common enough. You know, it's not a kind of a narrow build around me type of thing. It's something that you have a lot of room because there's a lot of artifacts out there. There's a lot of colored artifacts out there. Being able to just essentially in the game, plop him down on sometimes turn 3 and then in the game turn 4, I mean, that's super powerful. And that's what happens. You know, your opponent's going to lose 8-10 life and you're going to gain 8 or 10 life. And then you have other artifacts on the board, especially when you're running other, you know, other combo pieces. I think he is just, he's one of those. It's definitely an absolute, I think it's the only planeswalker in this kind of 4 mana and less that is, you answer me or I'm dead next turn.
That's interesting because you're looking at artifacts in this sort of archetype as not having that much of an opportunity cost to play because of both what they can do and then the payoff. So it's the synergy.
Yeah, it's the synergy. And the opportunity cost is... I think it's relatively low, but it's literally the only one I can think of that you can naturally cast on turn 4 that if you don't answer him on turn 5, you're probably dead. I mean, can you guys think of another one?
Not off the top of my head, but I mean, right now I'm reeling. I mean, I've literally been knocked from Kaladesh back to Chandelar by you picking him as your number one, so it'll just take me a minute to get over that. Brian, hit us with your top 5.
While Sean recovers from his jet lag, here we go. All right. At 5, I've got Karn. 4, I've got Ugin. 3, I've got Nahiri. And yes, I definitely think she belongs at number 3.
Wow.
I think that her loyalty defends her better than most people realize. She can take a couple hits, but her +2 is great. And, you know, she's in a red-white deck. There's going to be plenty of things. Her ability in Modern to be defended by even Lingering Souls, all kinds of token strategies, that kind of stuff is crazy. And it just makes her so dangerous. Because if you want to talk about a Planeswalker who can end the game as basically a, yep, I'm going to go search up Emrakul and attack you, Annihilator 6, that's going to happen if you don't deal with it. There's no other card like that. The other ones will give you incremental card advantage. They're going to tap down your opponent's creatures, et cetera, et cetera. She is the clock, and that's why I ranked her so high. 2, this is no surprise, Liliana of the Veil. And number 1, Hurley, you're just wrong, Jace the Mind Sculptor.
I gotta say, I've got a lot in common with Brian's top 5. My top 5, number 5, Karn Liberated. And there is a big difference between 7 and 8 in formats where Tron is legal. Looking at him on turn 3 is way different than looking at either one on turn 4. Because he's colorless, he can take care of so many different threats. The ability to attack the hand is something unique. And going right from 6 to 10 is something you want to talk about. Nahiri defending herself through gaining loyalty. That's something that Karn does, I think, better than anyone. For me, number 4... Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, when he grows up, and becomes a fully formed 4-mana white planeswalker, he'll be Elspeth Nidoran. She's the original 4-mana white aggressive Swiss Army knife, and she remains in the top 4 for me to this day. Oof. Number 3, you guys all had him ranked way too low, a Johnny Vengeant. He is...
I had number 4. So
the fact that you can get a control element from red white when he comes down and plus his loyalty while you have a chance to control the board, and then you can start using his -2 to not only remove threats but gain life at the same time. Those two abilities do what? They make your opponents play to the board in order to come get him, which means they can't sandbag. Which, if you can control the board while building his loyalty, means that his one-sided Armageddon is absolutely going to ruin him. So the tension between his first two abilities and his ultimate and the way they ask your opponent to play the game to take him off the board is just so amazing. And the fact that you get him for a 4-drop in colors that have very low casting cost answers to threats that can come get him. You're talking about Swords to Plowshares, Path to Exile, Lightning Bolt, Lightning Helix. These sorts of answers along the way, I think, make him very powerful because of the color combination that he is in. Number 2, if there is a format in which she is legal, someone will build a Jund-style deck around her. Liliana of the Veil, she was a staple in Standard, a staple in Modern. She is a staple in Legacy. She is used in multiple decks in each of those formats when she was legal in Standard, still used in multiple decks in Modern, still used in multiple decks in Legacy. She not only controls the board, but against Storm-type players, she attacks the hand as well. She gives you so much value for, in those formats, a Planeswalker that you can play with ramp on turn 1. The fact that she's 3 makes her light years ahead of the fact that if she was 2 and 2 black, she might not even make my top 25. But because she's 1 and 2 black, she's number 2 in my mind. And yes, you're right, Brian. Jace the Mind Sculptor, so far out in front of everyone else, he wasn't even aware there was a race for number 2 behind him.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that.
And here's why.
I absolutely think that Jace the Mind Sculptor, far and away, if Wizards ever print something that would even come close to Jace to challenging his number 1 spot, we're looking at a much different game than we ever learned how to play, that's for sure.
And here's why. I know Matt's thinking, well, why do they say that? Banned in Standard. Banned in Modern. He was printed as a 4-mana answer to Emrakul, the Aeon's Torn, when they came out. This is a card that you said, Matt, Agent of Bolas was good because you didn't have to use much of an opportunity cost to get the most out of him. Jace is just the opposite. You have zero opportunity cost used to build a deck. He is good no matter what deck you want to build. You want to keep your opponent off a specific answer? I'll do that. You want to draw 2 cards a turn while your opponent draws 1? I'll do that. You want to return something to their hand you don't have an answer to? Sure, that only costs you 1 loyalty. And if the game goes on for a while, I'll just make them try to beat me with the cards that were in their hand this turn. Otherwise, they lose the game. I mean, that's as close as you get to printing "you win the game" on an ultimate, Phage the Untouchable not being seen. This is something that is so good, he doesn't need any opportunity cost to build around him. He goes into every deck that wants to play 23 or more lands and blue. That's your opportunity cost to play Mind Sculptor.
Wow.
They were close. They were close. But yeah, I mean, he was... Agent of Bolas was number 2 for a while, but I'm just being able to just literally win the game on the next turn, it's a must answer. That's what Agent of Bolas bust out there. But I fully think none of these top three or top four will ever be printed in Standard again. I mean, you can't.
No,
they
could
not print, as much as people say, oh, Agent of Bolas in Standard, like in Aether Revolt, I don't think that they could print that.
Too good. With all the artifacts they have now, too good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, too good, but we're going to get a Tezzeret. Aren't we getting a Tezzeret in Aether Revolt?
I would be surprised if we don't.
And so, therefore, it's going to be interesting to see what Wizards thinks of power level. Because, you know, when some of those Planeswalkers were spoiled for Kaladesh, like Saheeli, everybody was kind of like, ooh, this is going to be really, really powerful, and ended up, meh. Not really so much.
Well, we haven't had that much time to sort of unwind that at this point. So while we're all expecting a new Tezzeret coming up in Aether Revolt, pop quiz poll right now. There's no right or wrong answer. Looking another set ahead, Amonkhet. We've already had it spoiled that this is kind of the return of Bolas. If we get a printing of a Bolas Planeswalker, will it cost more or less than Nicol Bolas Planeswalker?
I think it'll cost less. I think they've learned their lesson, but I think they want their Planeswalkers to kind of be the, you know, the flagship for their products.
Be played in standard.
Yeah. So, and even if Bolas was reprinted, and I mean, when was the last time he was reprinted? He was almost never played.
The fact that I think the most played that he's been has been in Eureka decks in Legacy, we'll tell you right there.
I think they've learned a lesson about printing these giant, flashy Planeswalkers that have a bunch of opportunity cost, and then they don't do anything.
I'm definitely on board with lower cost. I don't think Wizards, following suit for what they're wanting to do, you know, playing to the board, playing creatures, I think they'll support big creatures. I don't think they're going to support big, mana-hungry Planeswalkers going forward. I just don't think. I think those days are gone. It's going to take kind of a shift in, you know, appetites for the modern or for the current players to really get on board with that. And to be honest with you, I don't know if I would be on board with that. I don't know what to do about an 8-mana Planeswalker that's, you know, multiple colors. That's really, really hard. When Bolas was printed originally, we didn't have this popularity of Commander. We didn't have the popularity of Magic overall that we do now. And I think people want efficient cards that they can play either at the kitchen table or in tournaments. And that's what Wizards is going to give, that product.
We'll watch and see if that's what happens with Amonkhet. That was our chance to walk the Planeswalkers through the holiday season. We hope you enjoyed it with our top 25 here on TryHards. That takes us right up to this week's In the Elevator. If you thought that Planeswalker was going to protect themselves by making a little dork and hiding behind it, oh no. Matt's pick for In the Elevator is going to take care of all of that. Let's get in that elevator, secret or otherwise. Your pass is approved. Matt, who's in the elevator with us?
Pick up your Noxious Gearhawks. They're currently about $6 to $7 on TCG Player. This is another one that they're not going to see the play that Torrential Gearhawk will see. As time goes on, it has a lot of room to grow. You're going to hate it when these are, you know, $10 or so. So I would say pick them up for your personal play. I love this card. I think it's a very, very close second to Torrential Gearhawk. Go out and pick up your set. Noxious Gearhawk.
Somebody's obviously been shopping already this week. That's In the Elevator with Matt Hurley here on TryHards. That brings us up to this week's 3 minutes to Brew on TryHards. We throw out a card, kick it around for 3 minutes, look for new angles, or maybe tread some old ground and bring it back up to the forefront of your mind. It's my turn to pick this week on 3 minutes to Brew. Guys, there are baseline cards that Wizards has put out that moving ahead of their power level indicates an upsurge in that effect. And when they move below that power level, they're sort of backing off the gas, so to speak. We've seen this with counterspells. Cancel is the baseline. A colorless in the New World Order and blue, and you get to counter any target spell. Anything you get for that effect that's cheaper than that or gives you an additional benefit to that same mana cost with that effect is viewed as above that power curve. So it's with that in mind that I want to talk about a removal spell that Wizards has used as the new baseline. Before the New World Order, it was Doomblade. Well, now it's Murder. 1 black instant destroy target creature. Is this, as the baseline, effective in your mind to play, especially in an era in Standard now where we have vehicles? This has seen kind of a resurgence because it's a way to answer vehicles before triggers can happen. Brian, I'll start with you. The new baseline for removing a creature in black in the New World Order is Murder. Where do you see it falling?
I definitely see it as the new baseline for sure. This reminds me a little bit of where we were with removal with when Counterspell used to be a blue, and it was a counterspell for eons, it seemed like. And then suddenly Wizards decided that this was too cheap, and rightfully so, was too cheap for a counterspell. So then anything that costs blue then had to have some kind of, you know, caveat to it. Murder, being an instant, I think, at three is exactly where it should be, kind of at the common slot. I don't see this as being overpowered. I don't see it as being underpowered. I think it's exactly the kind of card that can slot in. You can put four of these in a deck, maybe not the most tier one deck, but it's going to definitely do what you need. It can destroy any creature. It does not have to be non-black. It does not have to be non-artifact, just kind of like go for the throat and things like this. The only drawback is the double black kind of limits it where it's going to be. However, this is right up Black's alley. This is exactly the flavor and design that is made for. And yeah, this seems completely comfortable in my world.
I'm making a new standard deck. I haven't told you guys about this yet. And I have four murders sitting right here that go in this deck. I think the cost is correct. I think having a Hero's Downfall where I can take care of a Planeswalker and a creature at instant was I wouldn't say a tad strong, but it was a little more versatile than they wanted. I think murder's just about perfect where you want it, and you need that instant speed removal. I mean, look at how much Grass of Darkness is getting played because of vehicles. So on a standard side of things, I think that's great. They could probably get away with a black and two colorless if they really wanted to go with it, and then keep the Planeswalker removal as black, black one. I really like it, and I do think that it's any black deck, it's probably a two of or more in those decks.
If they decide to go back to two colorless and black is the way to bury any non-black creature, first thing I'm doing is getting my Juggernauts back out of storage and getting back at it. Tibbetts, that's the way we used to roll. I think murder is perfectly fine where it is. In standard, I like a 2-1 split right now with two murder and one ruinous path, just because the planeswalkers that are played are so powerful. You guys, of course, talking about Gideon, Ally of Zendikar, a must-answer threat. So I think the one Ruinous Path is very good there. But murder as a cover-all answer, especially to a deck that's not going to splash white for Anguished Unmaking, I think is a very versatile answer, and one that in a world where Virtuous Gearhulk is a big threat is worth more than just maybe the fourth Grasp of Darkness, which once they put that counter on and it gets to a 5-5, really has limited value as a standalone answer. So I think murder, still very versatile and very worth it in control decks, especially ones that can easily come by double black. Our 3 minutes to brew tonight, murder here on Try Hard. So it just remains for us to talk about how we got better at Magic this week. I got better at Magic this week by not playing any Magic, eating way too much turkey, and drinking a whole lot of scotch. Guys, did you get on a similar plan that I was on?
Well, I was hoping I would get on a similar plan. I can probably attest I ate as much or more than you did. And you know I've never met food I didn't like, Sean.
You can put it away, dude.
No, how I got better at Magic this week, basically joined up with the local players, and we're doing a little thing that I'm actually pretty happy about. It tried to get off the ground last year, and it did not. And this year, it definitely is. We're doing a little Secret Santa among all the players at the LGS, where you send, we kind of got one person who's functioning as our hub, and you kind of put your little want dream list together of things that you're looking for, things that you're interested in, limit of $20. You get a name back with their want and desire list as well. And then we're meeting all up on the 16th of December at F&M, and we're going to kind of reveal, surprise, I'm your Secret Santa, here's your loot. And then, of course, enjoy F&M. And that's exactly what it's all about, is community. So I love that part, that kind of, you know, event can be spawned out of Magic. I just kind of wish it was more than a $20 limit, but I understand it's perfect for just kind of the idea of it. I put on mine, lands, nothing but lands.
Yeah, well, it's a great idea. Just stay away from the non-transferable digital loot box that Wizards is trying out online. Hurley, what about you? What did you do to get better at Magic?
Well, even though I played, the big one was I didn't really even pick up cards all weekend and ate way too much and recovered from these nice ear infection I've been fighting for a week. So that's all I did. I mean, I relaxed. Sean and I stopped over at Sean's, talked a little Magic, but now I'm kind of getting the itch again, so I'm going to try to play some this weekend and play some Legacy this week as well to prepare for GP Louisville in January.
Should be a fantastic week this week. We're leading into the SCG Invitational. So much tech seems to come out of that. Whether or not it's worth having a short field versus a large field, we'll have those discussions and more next week. You brave soul, planeswalking through the holidays with us and our top 25 walkers here on TryHards. More TryHards next week.